Okay, Hare Krishna. So we are going to read now from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 5, verse 39. The demigod said, O Lord, your lotus feet are like an umbrella for the surrendered souls, protecting them from all the miseries of material existence. All the sages under that shelter throw off all material miseries. We therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto your lotus feet. There are many sages and saints who engage in trying to conquer rebirth and all other material miseries, but of all of them, those who take shelter under the lotus feet of the Lord can completely throw off all such miseries without difficulty. Others who are engaged in transcendental activities in different ways cannot do so. For them it is very difficult. They may artificially think of becoming liberated without accepting the shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, but that is not possible. One is sure to fall again to material existence from such false liberation, even though one may have undergone severe penances and austerities. This is the opinion of the demigods, who are not only well versed in Vedic knowledge, but are also seers of the past, present, and future. The opinions of the demigods are valuable, because the demigods are authorized to hold positions in the affairs of universal management. They are appointed by the Lord as his confidential servants. Deva uchu namamate deva padaravindam prapannatapo pashamatapatram yanmulaketa yatayonja soru samsara dukkham bahirukshipanti. The demigod said, O Lord, your lotus feet are like an umbrella for the surrendered souls, protecting them from all the miseries of material existence. All the sages under that shelter throw off all material miseries. We therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto your lotus feet. Due to time, as I mentioned at the beginning, I've been a bit late today, unfortunately. One off, by Krishna's grace. Therefore, I'll do the short version of the Mangalacharan today. Om Jnana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Namo Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamiti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadhar, Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Vancha Kalpatarubhischa Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnanebhyo Namo Namaha. So I'd like to seek everyone's blessings, especially the seniors amongst us, that we can say something of value today on this verse. So we are continuing with the conversations between Vidura and Maitreya Rishi, and of course the wonderful questions that Vidura is asking, and then Maitreya Rishi is obviously responding to it as well. So it's interesting here, it actually says that the Lord's lotus feet are like an umbrella for the surrendered souls. And this is actually what this Krishna conscious movement is doing. It's actually providing an umbrella for people to connect to a spiritual process, regardless of whatever your mentalities and inclinations are, and then help you to kind of take that path towards Krishna. Just like when you're on a motorway, you know, people come on from various slip roads. I know this morning, I generally travel on the M1 here, and my God, M1 in the morning at a certain time becomes atrocious these days. There's a lot of roadworks going on. And then, so then I tried the slip road as well, the A1583 or something that goes straight onto junction 9 of the M1. But the point is all these little byways and by lanes and sideways, ultimately they're all coming onto the M1 to bring us to the Bhaktivedanta Manor for those who are traveling on the M1. So similarly, what this Bhagavatam is providing, what Krishna's lotus feet is providing, is that main path from which people, whatever their mentalities are, can come onto that main path and then attain perfection, regardless of what kind of spiritual mentality and you may have come with beforehand. Krishna consciousness will take whoever you are, whether you're coming from a Mayavadi background, a demigod worshipping background, Shaivite background, Karmakandic background, Smartha Brahmana background, or just no spiritual practice background whatsoever, right? The whole idea is that wherever you're coming from, that Krishna consciousness is there to provide for everyone and then bring them to Krishna shelter. We will talk a bit about that bit more, because there's a wonderful verse that I'd like to share with you from the Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Leela that pertains to this concept. Before that, I just want to also mention here that Prabhupada mentions at the bottom, the end of the purport, that this is the opinion of the demigods who are not only well-versed in Vedic knowledge, but also seers of past, present, and future. And, yesterday, of course, Radha Mohan Prabhu talked a lot about the demigods, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. But they are very much to be respected, revered. And, of course, so many devotees in Krishna consciousness now are coming from a demigod-worshipping background. There's also tremendous diversity amongst the demigods as well. Like, for example, in the Garga Samhita, it mentions that there are different expansions of Krishna. And some are called Amsa, and some are called Swamsa. These Swamsa expansions are the direct expansions of Krishna himself. They are otherwise known as Vishnu Tattva. They have the same properties and qualities of Krishna himself. Then there are those who are Amsa expansions, which are basically jivas, conditioned souls like you and me, so not on the same magnitude as Krishna, but they are still inheriting some of the qualities that Krishna has got to do their destiny and their purpose here in this material world. So a lot of the demigods, they fall in that category. In fact, all the direct expansions, the conditioned expansions coming from Krishna, they start off with the highest demigod of them all, which is Lord Brahma. Okay? Aside from that, there are also the Kala expansions. These are expansions of expansions. So that's why sometimes you might get bewildered, like how many incarnations and expansions of Krishna are there? There's actually innumerable ones, but there are also difference in gradations between them. And amongst the demigods, you'll see some are direct expansions of Krishna under the Jiva Tattva category. Then there are those who are expansions of expansions, which is known as the Kala expansions as well. Okay, and they, of course, take care of all the affairs of the universal government and everything that they're doing. And like what Radha Mohan Prabhu said yesterday, the level of competence and professionalism that they need to demonstrate in their duties is actually beyond our comprehension. Their levels of powers is beyond our comprehension, and so is the level of their competence. Because if they make anything wrong, that could completely put the whole universe into imbalance. It's interesting. This morning, I was just reading a verse. Not this verse, a different verse. Part of one's daily reading, shall we say, in Srimad Bhagavatam. And in it, it's actually said here, Prabhupada is saying here, this is from Canto 4, Chapter 18, Verse 4. This is when Prithu Maharaj is milking the earth planet. We'll come to that, I'm sure, in a few months' time. And Prabhupada is saying that the word avraha, meaning inexperienced, is very significant in this verse. Every conditioned soul is inexperienced. Everyone is abhodha jata, born a fool and rascal. In democratic government at the present moment, all kinds of fools and rascals are making decisions. But what can they do? What is the result of their legislation? They enact something. I thought this is very pertinent what Prabhupada says here. They enact something today just to whimsically repeal it tomorrow. And for those of you who have ever followed politics right now, the modern age, you'll see this, right? Whether it's elections in this country, in America, in India, or whatever it is, you'll see this happening, right? So they enact something today just to whimsically repeal it tomorrow. One political party utilizes the country for one purpose, and the next moment, another political party forms a different type of government and nullifies all the laws and regulations. This is the process of chewing the chewed. Now, of course, this is Prabhupada is talking in respect to our modern day earthly governments. Now imagine if that was to be done, if that kind of whimsical changing of rules and regulations was done amongst the demigods on a higher level. Imagine what kind of chaos that would be causing for us. But they don't do that. They actually are they take their services very seriously. And they do take it as a service because Prabhupada also mentions they are natural devotees. They are not what you call career politicians, which is a very kind of like the modern phenomenon where you make a career out of being a politician. In the olden days, even on the earth planet, people would be politicians out of a sense of destiny. You know, like this is my calling that I need to serve the people in this way. I don't know. I mean, maybe some are still like that. Don't get me wrong. But a lot of it could be they're just using the political system to milk what they can. Okay. So therefore, we can see this, that in the demigods, they are excellent at what they do. They are natural devotees. They actually oversee us on a macro level. That is the, you know, the whole workings of the cosmos. But even on a micro level as well, there are demigods in charge of every single function of our body, right? All the way from the power of speech to the power of blinking our eyes, even to the power of evacuating. I mean, it's in the Bhagavatam, they talk about the Mitra, right? They're in charge. This demigod is in charge of the evacuation. Imagine if those demigods decide to kind of like, you know, not do their duty. Imagine then you can't blink. How horrible would that be that you can't blink anymore, you know? And then the eyes will dry up and things. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda ki. Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ji ki. Shri Shri Gaunitai ki. So yeah, these demigods, they take charge of the intimate things that we do. Imagine you cannot evacuate. Imagine what kind of diseases that will cause in the body. Horrible, horrible. So we have lots to thank the demigods for. At the same time, and I know that a lot of people, in the olden days, demigod worship was very prevalent all around the world. Whether you call it pagan worship or this kind of nature, you know, elemental worship, but, you know, nature worship. When you're worshipping nature, you're worshipping a certain manifestation of nature, but there is some demigod behind that manifestation who's actually making that nature work in that way. So whichever way you look at it, demigod worship has been very prevalent. Of course, we know that in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that those who worship demigods are also known as Alpamedasa. They are people of small intelligence. Yes, that is true, but we need to now contextualize it. Prabhupada also mentions that demigods should be 100% respected. In the initial days when ISKCON was being developed, there was a mood of neglecting demigods or looking down, derisive of demigod worship. But Prabhupada is very clear that, you know, even when you go past a demigod temple, in the West you may not find that so much, but at least in the East, when you go to India and place like that, you may come across demigod temples. You definitely will, even when you go to the Holy Dhams, one should pay obeisance there at these demigod places. One should then also pray to them to help you to develop your connection to Krishna. And that's the key thing here. A lot of people, when they worship demigods, initially, yes, demigod worship is often seen as like a business transaction, that we're there to just kind of like, you know, get something from them for what we want. But if you look at a lot of people that worship demigods, they end up developing a lot of bhakti for them. You know, in fact, dare I say, there's a lot of demigod worshippers who have more bhakti for their chosen demigods than maybe devotees may have for Krishna, right? Now, so does that mean that bhakti has gone to waste? No. What Krishna does is he then guides that person who worships a certain demigod to then channel that bhakti towards Krishna. And that is what the demigods themselves are happy for their devotees to do. For them, that's a success that, you know, my devotee is now connecting to Krishna. Okay? So, this is why we have so many people coming from demigod worship to Krishna's lotus feet. Okay, so, but they are still fallible beings. their places that they oversee are also fallible. We know Krishna even says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Punaravartin Arjuna. Every single planet in this material world, from the highest to the lowest, are all places of misery. In Canto 4 as well, it's said that this secondary creation, it's made by Brahma, but Brahma himself is created by the Supreme Godhead. Even Lord Shiva, who annihilates the whole creation, at the end, this is a quote, this is from 4.11.19, at the end, he is also annihilated by Lord Vishnu. Only Lord Vishnu remains. Of course, I don't want to get too deep into that because it's like Krishna, we know that Lord Shiva is also eternal. It could be the, you know, the material form of Krishna that manifests, of Lord Shiva that manifests, because Lord Shiva has his spiritual eternal form, but then he also manifests as a form in the material world as well. So it could be, you know, temporary form as well. But here we can see that the demigods have started to pray. And this demonstrates the supremacy of Krishna. The demigods themselves are bound to Krishna. Which is why when we also bow to Krishna, it says that when we take darshan of Krishna, we should start with Krishna's feet. Because that is the ultimate umbrella, the ashraya, the shelter of all people. And then you work your way up. Okay? And through these prayers, it's also showing the supremacy of bhakti over all other processes. We can see this again in the Bhagavatam. We have the example of Maharaj Ambarish and Durvasa Muni. Durvasa Muni was a great, great tapasya, renunciate, someone who performed tremendous austerities, and, a sannyasi, considered higher in one sense. But Ambarish Maharaj, on the other hand, was a king, externally so-called a worldly king. But when it came down to the conflict between them, we saw that it was Ambarish Maharaj who won. How did he win? Because he's the one that demonstrated self-control. Durvasa Muni was the one that lost his composure, even though Ambarish Maharaj was externally on a lower level. But he wasn't on a deeper level because he was a bhakta. He engaged all his services in Krishna's service, thinking of Krishna, and engaging his hands in Krishna's worship. Whereas Durvasa Muni was more of a kind of like a meditator, you know, doing dhyana yoga, but not necessarily like a full-on bhakti there as well. So, and we can see there's many, many other examples of this as well, of where the devotees demonstrate how they are higher than the non-bhakta yogis, shall we say. Okay. It should also be understood here that a lot of the sages and saints who try to conquer the material miseries, they might do it through other ways. And often, especially those who are coming from an impersonalistic background, they try to shut themselves off from the world. But in Canto 4, it's said that actually sages and saintly persons and devotees are not unconcerned with people's welfare. In other words, a bhakta, he will do his sadhana, his tapasya, but he won't shut himself off from the world. He will do whatever he can to help the people around him, to bring them to Krishna's lotus feet as well. In fact, recently I was listening to a class where it said that a devotee was asking, how do I purify myself? And the person actually said, you purify yourself by preaching. If you want to, you don't need to go to a mountain or a hermitage, and do your own tapasya by yourself. If you really want to get purified, try to spread Krishna consciousness in society. You'll see how difficult that is. And then you'll see all the purification will come for you. So devotees are the highest because not only do they have Krishna's lotus feet, but they're trying to also share that with everyone around them as well. I'll just share something. This is a very beautiful verse. This is from Adi Lila, chapter 4, 165. I'm sure some of you may have heard this verse before. It says, Atmendriya priti vancha tare boli kam, Krishnandriya priti cha dhare premanam. So the desire to satisfy one's senses is called lust, but the desire to satisfy the senses of Krishna is called love. So I'm just going to pull up the purport, because there's one beautiful part of this purport which I thought is very relevant for this. Yeah. Okay, so. Okay, this is in the purport. Prabhupada mentions this. All the regulative principles in the Vedas pertaining to desires for popularity, fatherhood, wealth, and so on are different phases of sense gratification. A lot of the times when people do spiritual practices, they generally want to go for popularity, wealth. It says here fatherhood, I'll extrapolate and say good family. Prabhupada goes on to say, acts of sense gratification may be performed under the cover of public welfare, nationalism, religion, interesting, altruism, ethical codes, biblical codes, health directives, fruitive action. Okay, so these are all activities. Then it goes into qualities: bashfulness, tolerance, personal comfort, liberation from material bondage, progress, family affection, fear of social ostracism or legal punishment. All of these, I mean, you know, if you think about a lot of what, you know, like if you look at great people in the world who you appreciate for the austerities they've done, historical personalities and figures, a lot of them would probably be classed under these categories here. But Prabhupada, he's not, you know, he's not messing about here. He says straight away, all these categories are different subdivisions of one substance, which is sense gratification. All such good acts are performed basically for one's own sense gratification. For no one can sacrifice his personal interest whilst discharging much advertised moral and religious principles. So now when you look at here, if you look at this purport in the verse in question, many sages and saints trying to conquer rebirth or even trying to conquer the material miseries, they will fail if you don't take shelter of the Lord's lotus feet. You can do these penances and austerities for social welfare, health, trying to teach the world, trying to, like, you know, develop like different projects. But it's not just even social stuff. I mean, look at what Prabhupada says here. Even moral things like biblical codes and religion is still not enough. What we want is Keval Bhakti, Ananya Bhakti, where it's nothing but the Lord's lotus feet. So I'm conscious of the time. Yeah, it also says here, Prabhupada says here, the demigods are seers of the past, present, and future. So we can see that as well. There are different examples. For example, in the Mahabharata, we have the example of Suryadev predicting that Indra is going to approach Karna to ask him for his armor and his earrings to take away his power. Only a person of that level can actually understand what's going on and try to warn his own celestial son that don't give your armor, your magical armor and your earrings to Indra, who's going to come in disguise as a Brahmana. Does anyone know any other examples of demigods who have demonstrated understandings of the past and the future? It's a difficult one, maybe. Sorry? Okay, yes, go on. Oh, Nalakurera and Hayagriva. Sorry? Managriva, sorry, not Hayagriva. Yes. That's right, yes, yes. In the two boys, the Gandharva boys, who then obviously insulted Narad Muni. And Narad Muni then predicted that, I'm going to curse you as trees now, but in the future, you will be liberated by Lord Krishna himself, which then gave rise to the Damodar Leela. Yes, that's a very good example. There's also the example of Lord Brahma predicting who the husband of Revati will be. So remember when Revati from Satyayuga went up to Lord Brahma's palace in the higher planets with her father to look for a suitable groom. And Lord Brahma said, by the time you go back down, the Yugas will have passed and there'll be Lord Balaram there who will be your husband, right? But then they also can predict previous things as well, like Ganga Devi. Ganga Devi, when she had the knowledge that the eight Vasus will then take birth as her own sons. And she knew that her role was to then immediately, as soon as they come, to liberate them, those boys from the material bodies so they can go back to their celestial realms. Except for the eighth one who stayed on, who obviously became Bhishma Dev. So the demigods, their knowledge of the world and how it works is much more high than ours. But even they themselves are prostrating themselves before Krishna. So if they can do that, who are we? So therefore, we should definitely take lessons from that to make sure that we are doing the same thing. In the Ishopanishad, it's also said, and I'll finish on this point, in the Ishopanishad, it's also said that better than impersonal... No, it says that when people worship demigods, this is text 8, I believe. When people worship demigods, they go into darkness. But even more so do the impersonalists. So in other words, if you focus on just worshipping demigods, as great as they are, but if you consider the demigods to be your sole focus, eventually at some point it's going to just lead you into darkness. Why? Because this material world is a place of darkness. The only reason we have light in this world is because obviously, you know, the sun is there to give the light. Otherwise, it's literally a dark place, right? But the whole point is that the demigods, you can worship them, worship them, and worship them life after life, but you're still going to be trapped in this place. But at least that's still better than being an impersonal worshipper, right? This is from Ishopanishad. Why is it better to be a demigod worshipper than an impersonalistic worshipper? Because both are keeping you in the darkness. Any ideas? Yes, Ruben Prabhu. Oh, I'll go with Prabhuji and then, yeah.
I heard it said that when someone goes to the priest in the temple and does his pujas to the demigods, if he's a qualified brahmana, he will explain that the demigods are the servants of the Lord. And slowly they will get elevated to the point of understanding that let me worship the minister of all the ministers.
Yeah, thank you, Prabhu. Yes, Prabhuji, what did you?
The demigod in a form we are accepting it. Instead of the Maya, no form.
Yes, yes, true, absolutely, that's true as well, yeah. So both Prabhujis, yeah, absolutely. You see, at least with the demigods, you're getting taught about personism. You're getting taught about accountability to an authority, to a person who you can devote yourself to. Within impersonalism, there's none of that. So that's still better. That's still one step closer to than worshipping the personality of Godhead. So that's very much. Demigods themselves, as I mentioned, though, they are themselves fallible. There are so many examples we have of demigods themselves falling prey to their own temptations. Also, this is what I found very interesting. Because, you know, I mentioned at the beginning, there are diversity within the demigods. Some are much more higher than others, right? Like, you know, Lord Brahma would be much more of a higher caliber personality than, let's say, a Vidyadhar or a Gandharva, right? In the Ishopanishad, in that same verse, text 8, it said that dependent demigods and great sages imperfectly consider him being Krishna, to be a powerful demigod. And they consider the Brahman effulgence to be the absolute truth. But the devotees of Krishna, by dint of their surrendering unto him and their unalloyed devotion, can know that he's the absolute. So this is interesting. That means there is a possibility that even amongst demigods, there could be some philosophical misconceptions. Maybe not the higher level demigods, but at least some of them, because Prabhupada is saying here in the purport that a lot of great sages and dependent demigods imperfectly may consider Krishna to be a demigod himself, which I thought was telling as well. So therefore, either way, whether you're a demigod, a great sage, a great saint, or a lot of us, myself, speaking for myself, mere mortals, it means that we should just understand that only Krishna's lotus feet can be the umbrella for all of us and nothing else. He's the only one that we can go to. Okay, I shall pause here. Time's finished. If we want to go for breakfast, unless if there is any last questions or anything, then yeah, Parama Karuna Prabhu.
Thank you, Prabhu, for the class. We hear regularly that we should be at the feet of the Lord, lotus feet of the Lord, or we should take shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, or the devotees are at the lotus feet of the Lord, or the spiritual master. What does it mean to be at the lotus feet of the Lord, or to take shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord? What does it mean that the devotees or the spiritual master is at the lotus feet of the Lord?
Yeah, really, really good question, Prabhu. So there's the literal aspect where you literally put yourself at their feet. Like, you know, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it said, Bhakta pada dulyaro, bhakta pada jal, bhakta bhakta avasheshe teen mahabal, that these three aspects, the dust of the lotus feet of the devotees, the archman, the water with which they worshipped, and their remnants, these three substances, if one was to take these substances and, you know, consume them, then one will attain full perfection. So there is a literal aspect to it. But there's also a more, I would say, a deeper understanding that it doesn't mean that, you know, you have to always be like, you know, like when your guru comes, you have to, like, when he's sitting on the sofa, you have to kind of put yourself, you know, like near his feet and try and get your head to touch his, you know, connect it to the, like, guru's feet at all times. You know, the guru might think you're a bit weird if you were to do that all times, you know. And, you know, Prabhupada said, right, that, you know, like when one devotee said to Prabhupada that, oh, Prabhupada, I want to be at your, you know, your feet all the time. And Prabhupada said that, I mean, this fly is on my leg all the time. It doesn't mean that it's doing much, you know. Like, so I think there's also, like, taking the mood, taking the intentions and the wishes of the guru, of the Lord, right, of the great saints, and making that the center of your life, the center goal, so that every single, whatever you're doing in your life, it should all be lending itself to that one mission, which is how can I fulfill the intention or the instructions that the guru or the acharya has given me. So that also means being under their lotus feet at all times. And that means that whatever decisions you make in life, you have to question yourself, does this lend itself to me acting in accordance with, you know, let's say the guru's wishes? Or if it not, then leave it. Every time you make a choice in life, you have to look at, okay, does this lend itself in line with the mission that Krishna has given me? It means also taking responsibility for the mission which the guru has given to you, or the great acharyas have given to us. It means relinquishing our own whimsy and making sure that we're doing it completely in line. Ekatvam, being one in intention and mood. It doesn't mean literally just being trying to be one with the Lord, obviously, but it means being one in actions and mood. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you, Paul. It's just that the language is always used at the feet rather than instructions or wishes of the Lord. So every time we kind of hear more of being at the lotus feet in the verses, in the purports, and so on.
Yeah. Instructions are obviously also mentioned in scriptures as well, but before one can take instructions and trying to follow, there needs to be complete obedience. You have to completely accept that you are your, like, I remember when I got initiated, like the day before, my spiritual master saying that, look, when you get initiated, basically, you are like your guru, you are basically your guru's property. For you to acknowledge that you are now your guru's property is as good as basically you being under their feet at all times. So it's having that mood of that I'm at my feet, because then if you surrender to that concept, then it'll be easier for you to take the other things that follow. The instructions, the mission, the responsibility, all those things. As long as you have that in place first.
And there was a past time where Prabhupada was asked, oh, I would like to remain at your lotus feet. And then Prabhupada said, I'm always traveling, so how will you remain at my feet?
Yeah, again, but I feel that is, you see, these statements needs to be contextualized. Like being under Prabhupada's lotus feet, sometimes people may say it in a mood of what's the word, like, you know, hyperbole, where, you know, like people say, oh Prabhu, let me take the, you know, I am nothing but a dust at your lotus feet. And often it's just people are just saying it for the sake of saying it. And in devotee circles, often people do this, right? Like they do the humility talk. But actually, what is real? Actual humility is like, it's not always like, you know, that external display. It's actually, are you seriously going to take the guru's like instructions? Like, often it's not about being like sometimes, you know, we might fall into the trap of being a fan of Srila Prabhupada, being a fan of the guru. Whereas what the guru wants is for you to be a follower. There's a difference between being a fan and a follower, right? So I think that's why we have to take the spirit of the statement and not just the externals of it. Yeah. Yes, Parajana Prabhu.
Sorry. He talks about demigods. It says here in chapter 11, this text 32. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Time I am, the great destroyer of worlds. I've come here to destroy all people, with the exception of you, the Pandavas. All of the soldiers here on both sides will be slain. Therefore, get up and prepare to fight. Win glory. Conquer your enemies. Enjoy a flourishing kingdom. They are already put to death by my arrangement. And you, Satya Yasi, can be but an instrument in my fight." He says, "Therefore, get up and kill them. Do not be disturbed. Simply fight, and you will vanquish all your enemies in the battle." After hearing these words, Sanjaya said, "The God, Personality of Godhead, offered obeisances and folded hands. You fearfully spoke to the Lord as in a faltering voice. Arjuna said, 'O master of the senses, the world has become joyful by seeing and hearing your joyful name. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. Become attached to you. All perfection beings, they offer you their respective homage. The demons, they're afraid, they flee. And all this is rightly done. O great one, greater than Brahma. Why should they not offer obeisances unto you, O limitless one, the God of gods, refuge of the universe? You are invincible. You are the cause of all causes. You are the original personality of Godhead. I therefore take, you are the knower of everything. You are all that is knowable. You are the supreme refuge of all above the material modes. O limitless form, you are the air, the fire, Brahma, the living creature. I therefore offer you all respected obeisances, front and back, unbounded power. Thinking of you, my friend, I have rashly addressed you as my friend, knowing all your glories. I now may have done what I've done in madness of love and dishonor you. You are the father, the moving of the non-moving. You are the supreme master. nor can anyone with you. You, how then could anyone be greater than you in all the worlds? You are the Supreme Lord, to be worshipped by every living being. I fall down and offer all obeisances at your lotus feet.
Thank you. Thank you, Prabhuji. So we'll conclude here. I mean, just one thing Prabhujana Prabhu mentioned, like time being the eternal, all-devouring factor, and just relating to the demigods and sages and saints, especially demigods, it says actually in this same canto, third canto, in chapter 29, when Kapiladev is describing Shankha Yoga to his mother, Devahuti, and he mentions that actually every single planet, every single living entity, every single demigod in this world is performing their duties, not just out of a sense of austerity, but also out of fear of Krishna, because it's a criminal world that we're in. And so in a criminal world, you need a firm hand of discipline. So Krishna does manifest himself as that fearful, firm hand of discipline in the form of time. And that's what keeps even the demigods in line. So this again also shows how the demigods themselves are fallible, but obviously much more higher than us. But ultimately, the main person that we have to surrender to is Krishna himself. Jai. Granthra Srimad Bhagatam ki. Jai.